Before getting into my formal talk about bows and vows, I'd like to say a word about meditation in particular and practice in general. In my view, I think practice involves two things, being with and working with conditions, both external and internal. And those two aspects, being with and working with, are like the wings of a bird. It needs two wings to fly. In terms of working with, it's appropriate to rest attention on what draws the heart, what is healthy, wholesome, skillful, wise, resting attention there, and through neuroplasticity and other processes that are physical, increasingly establishing those qualities within ourselves so that they dwell increasingly within us and we take them with us wherever we go. It's completely appropriate to do that. And meanwhile, being with all that is the foundational practice. It's where we start. It's what we need to do to be able to work with anything skillfully. And as the fruits of working with your own mind and external conditions to some extent, you know, accumulate in your own life, in the upper reaches of practice, more and more, we're simply being with what's arising as it passes away. So being with is foundational. That said, there is a place for training attention to be able to stay with something. So we train it often by resting it on the breath. And as we train our attention to be able to stay with things, we can identify and increasingly rest in beautiful qualities of being, such as compassion or tenderness or lovingness or contentment. And as we lean into that which is beneficial, of course, some of the times what comes up are blocks to that. Like we're scared of leaning into it because then we might want it and get disappointed if we don't have it. Or maybe we've been told it's not ours to lean into, or it's bad, or, you know, that's sinful, or that's for other people, not for you. Whatever might come up, you know, leaning into what's good surfaces blocks to it, which are very useful to practice with. There might also be a spiritual belief, which I've discerned in many quarters, that I think is deeply mistaken in terms of the teachings of the Buddha, as well as the practical necessities of the developmental path of healing, growing, and awakening, which involves changing physical systems, especially in the brain, that don't just change on their own. They need a little working with skillfully over time, or a lot of it, at least in my case. So, you know, it's really okay to rest in something like contentment, even if also around the edges are things like disappointment and frustration and drivenness. Okay, that too. I'll get to this more, but okay, I can bow to frustration. I can bow to disappointment. I can bow to discontent. And meanwhile, I'm also bowing to contentment and increasingly dwelling in it. That's okay. That's a good part of practice. It's good in meditation and it's good in life in general. And interestingly, as I said briefly, positive emotions are factors of steadiness of mind. Technically, one of the ways this happens in your brain is that we sustain attention to what gives us a steady stream of dopamine reward. But if what we're attending to gets less rewarding, well, then we look for other rewards. Or if we suddenly become aware of something that's even more rewarding over there, we start shifting attention to that other little shiny object. And, you know, the brain is kind of continuously tossing up one thing after another to pay attention to. Look at me. No, look at me. Oh, over here, right? And a lot of steadying the mind is about becoming increasingly mindful in real time of those, you know, calls for attention and increasingly being able to be a choice, being free, as I said at the very beginning, in terms of what we choose to engage with and what we just disengage from. And so as we practice, you know, if you're able to sustain attention to something that feels positive, you get steady dopamine coming, so you're staying with it. And if what you're paying attention to is pretty juicy, pretty appealing, even something subtle like contentment or tranquility, but yeah, yummy. Well, then it's so rewarding that nothing else can compete with it for attention. you know, in some Darwinian sense, in the theater of the mind. That's one reason why happiness is skillful means, and one reason neurobiologically why in traditional Buddhist contemplative practice, happiness and even bliss are considered worthy of development, including as factors of deep concentration and non-ordinary states of awareness. So I encourage you to lean into all that and to let yourself have the good stuff. Okay? Well, that goes to what are we bowing toward and what are we vowing or declaring ourselves about? So we routinely see people bowing to this, bowing to that. It's easy to do it in kind of a perfunctory way as a simple show of respect. Okay, that's fine. And I wanted to explore with you more deeply, what are you bowing toward in two regards? First, as an expression of thankfulness or respect, pardon me, appreciation. You know, do you appreciate a friend? Can you bow in that direction? Can you appreciate the efforts that you've made already in your life? And can you therefore bow gratefully to previous versions of yourself? That is a very powerful kind of bow. As you go through your day, thinking about great teachers who talk about gratitude, can you bow in the direction, you know, of the flowers, the little flower that is blooming up through a crack in the sidewalk? You know, can you bow with gratitude to people who are taking care of the world? So many people maintaining streets, you know, building infrastructure, teaching children, doing the little things that keep the world going. Can you bow in those directions? So I wondered right now if you would care to ask yourself, kind of experientially, what do you bow toward? What are you thankful for? And how might it serve you in your practice to be more mindful and deliberate about to name what you bow to bow in the direction of what you're thankful for? What are some of the things that you bow toward? And how do you do that? I'll give you two personal examples. One is that quite often at a meal, I will take a few moments and look at the lettuce on the plate or the tomato or something else there. And I'll consider, how did that tomato get there? Wow, tomato. Thank you, tomato. Right? And I think, well, let's see, we got it at a store down the street from where I live. We didn't grow it in our backyard. Okay. How did that tomato get there? Well, people brought it there. It got set out on a shelf. Many hands touched it. You know, it grew in a field somewhere. Someone took care of that tomato plant so that the causes and conditions were cultivated to develop a tomato. And then, nerd that I am, I think back on the domestication of plants. You know, 30,000 years ago, there weren't really ripe, luscious, modern tomatoes. Those have been gradually domesticated over thousands of years. Oh, thank you all those people who did all those things to bring that tomato to my plate. Think of the systems. You know, maybe those systems are some fraught and complicated, like transportation systems that use fossil fuels to bring tomatoes from the field to one's plate in our modern lives. Okay. And thank you, all that it took to put that tomato on my plate. And then, nerd also that I am, I reflect on the sunlight that was required for that tomato plant. And the ways in which sitting there on my plate, all red and juicy, is congealed sunlight. Thank you, sun. You know, thank you, universe. Thank you, the ways in which smashing together hydrogen atoms deep in the heart of the sun, you know, to form squishing helium, releases a bunch of energy that eventually gets congealed into the bright red globe sitting on my plate, waiting for my fork and knife. Thank you, tomato. It's kind of wild to just appreciate what we eat and to feel that what's coming into you is literally all the goodness of all the causes and conditions that led to that tomato on your plate. Wow. You know, that's a practice. Many people do something quite like that when they eat, to think about even the elements in the tomato, you know, that which is earth, wood, wind, fire, air, different ways of thinking about elements right there coming into you, making you a tomato. If you're meditating, do you bow before or after? Or in any way, do you have anything in your life that's kind of significant for you that you have a bowing practice in relationship to? Many people, for example, bow to their ancestors, including those who walked the land that we might so casually pave over today. I've been reflecting recently on the amazing fact that everyone here had a mother. I could also say father, but I'll keep it simple. And your mother had a mother who had a mother who had a mother who must have had a mother who also must have had a mother, in an unbroken line stretching back 300,000 years to the first humans who had a mother, who had a mother, stretching all the way back, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, to the origins of life on Earth. Wow, thank you. Recently, I've been going through our garage and processing a whole bunch of stuff from our history. And one thing that's really startling to realize is how much work it is to raise children. So I could see that in the early photographs and, you know, in pictures of our own little family. And I can see that as well in the history of my own family. All the work that my mom and my dad did to, you know, keep it all going. And then their mother and father. And sure, we can acknowledge the not so good parts sometimes in that lineage upstream. And I'm not trying to sugarcoat anything here. I'm just naming a traditional reflection, which is to bow to your ancestors or pick some ancestors that could be worthy for you to be thankful for. Thank you. People also bow to the natural world, to life. Wow, life. Thank you. You know, those little robotic rovers on Mars are searching. They've been searching for many years now for signs of life there on a planet that had liquid water on its surface, you know, recently, you know, like 2 billion years ago, and yet not yet found any signs of life. I mean, either Earth has the only life in our galaxy or even universe, or it doesn't, or there's life elsewhere. Either option is pretty remarkable, right? But meanwhile, we can sure appreciate the life on our planet and the web of life. And that's a traditional bow of gratitude or thankfulness as well. You can also make bows that are more abstract. And I'll share kind of personally a three that have been quite central for me over, including currently. So when I meditate, often, I'll bow three times before I start and three times when I'm finished. And the three that I bow to is, first, I bow to the mysterious absolute, the infinite, timeless, unconditioned, potentially conscious and loving ground of all. Some people might call that God or spirit. Some people might not choose to bow in that direction. It's fine. I'm just sharing. When I bow to, you might also, interestingly, if there are people you can ask this question of that are close to you, or perhaps other teachers, what do you bow to, right? Because what we bow toward, what we're thankful for, is where increasingly we hope to dwell. A second bow for me is to the teachings, particularly Buddhist teachings, and really grateful for the Dharma and the account of the mind, the practical tools, the analysis, all the hard work and the know-how, you know, the best practices in our lineage. And then third, I bow in the direction of my future self, my future person process going forward. You know, good luck, future you. Good wishes. You know, hang in there, kid. You're getting older every day. You know? And you might add something from your heart as you bow. You know, like, again, I'll be honest with you. When I make that first bow, what arises in my mind is love you. Love you. Right? We become one with what we love. Love you. And that second bow for the teachings is thank you. Thank you. And the words that come up for that third bow in the direction of my future person process is bless you. You know, with kind of this quality of encouraging and guiding. Bless you as you go forward facing difficulties in this life. So you might consider that in some version of that for yourself. So we have bows of gratitude, bows of thankfulness, and we can, if we choose, adopt formal practices of bowing. Another common category is bowing toward refuge or refuges. We all need refuges, you know, refueling stations, pit stops, oases, you know, places of safe harbor as we go through this life. And, you know, there are many different refuges we can bow in the direction of. You probably know that in Buddhism, the three classic refuges, sometimes referred to as the three jewels, are named as the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Buddha is both the historical teacher in whom we can have some confidence, and Buddha as that capacity within every being to know what is true in ways that are liberating. Dharma is both that which is true and accounts of what is true that we can take refuge in, you know, a thoughtful, credible account of how the mind works in many regards, and what we can do about it. And we can take refuge in the Sangha, both the vertical dimension of a kind of hierarchy of respect and appreciation of depth of practice and moral fiber. And we can also appreciate Sangha in its horizontal dimension as others, peers that we gather with on the path. That might be bows for you. What might you bow, you know, to in that direction? Over the years, I've taken refuge in different things. And one way to frame this is not just I take refuge or I go for refuge, but I abide as Buddha. I abide as Dharma. I abide as Sangha, so that there's an embodied immediacy of it that's non-dual, in which, you know, you are one with what you are bowing toward or bowing as. These are nice points of skill in how we deal with all that. Over the years, I've bowed to different things that have been important for me. You might consider for yourself bowing to practice, you know, the nuts and bolts, the grounded practice. You know, I respect practice. I respect effort, bowing to effort. I really appreciate science. Wow, thank you, all those people who've developed a credible body of knowledge, credible because it is continually under, you know, pressure and refinement. So that which remains, you can count on until it gets revised further. Anyway, so for you, where do you take refuge? Where do you bow? What are you thankful for? Yes. Then there's the second aspect of bowing that can be more challenging, in which we bow to reality as it is, including aspects that are challenging, grieving and mourning. You know, I and many others are quite in touch with aspects of grieving and mourning in their life. And I saw a distinction recently that I thought that really helped me, at least, that grief is intense and immediate, and sometimes just completely compelling. It takes you, it occupies you, understandably, there it is, grief. Mourning is kind of grieving, can gently sometimes become increasingly mourning, in which there is the loss, there is the grief, there is the mourning, and there is more and more around it. Not taking away from what is still there, that loss, that hurt, that regret, maybe that remorse, and there is more and more around it. So grieving, mourning, so forth. Well, we can bow to that. We can bow to having a heart that is big enough to be able to grieve. We can, you know, bow to the reality of, you know, the hurricane. We can bow to the reality of cruelty or oppression or despotism, tyranny. Doesn't mean we like it or agree with it. It means that we accept its reality. Doesn't mean that we acquiesce to it. Doesn't mean that we countenance it. It means that this too, as Tara Brach puts it, this too belongs. This too is part of the whole. I bow to that part of the whole. Bowing as facing, not turning away, a releasing of aversion. It may still be very unpleasant. It may still shock our conscience. It may stir up moral outrage appropriately. And this too is real. That too is real. That too arose due to causes and conditions. We bow to it. We accept it. Sometimes what we bow to is not so much, you know, a challenge or a problem, but it's a simple inherent aspect of reality. You know, in Buddhism, the Buddha noted three fundamental aspects of existence. And one of them really needs to be carefully understood. So these are, in Pali, a language of early Buddhism, anicca, anatta, and dukkha. Anicca is impermanence, transience. Can we bow in the direction of impermanence? Can I accept it? Even as my hair turns gray and my teeth hurt or my back has pain or, you know, I lose loved ones and friends who, you know, I'm saying this for you too. Can we bow to impermanence? I accept impermanence. I face impermanence. I bow to impermanence. Anicca means interdependence, so that nothing has self-creating absolute existence, that all that which arises due to causes and conditions will change and pass away due to causes and conditions. That's anicca. One of whose key implications is that the presumed single entity of me is actually a kind of illusion. It's a useful fiction, but actually the apparent self is continually made of many parts that are changing. Then there's dukkha, the fact that sometimes it hurts in life, the fact that all pleasant experiences end one way or another, and the fact that because of anicca and anatta, we cannot hold on to anything. Experiences are continuously moving through our fingers. If we accept that, we're okay. There's no escape from that fact. There's no escape from the three aspects of dukkha that I've named so far, even as a Buddha. But if we can relate to dukkha without craving, then there's no suffering. There may be pain, but there's no suffering. Anicca, anatta, and dukkha. We can bow to dukkha. We can bow to anatta. We can bow to anicca. So, what are your bows? And what might serve you in adopting even formally certain bows? Maybe not enacted physically, although in many traditions, these are enacted physically. You know, I have monastic friends who, one of whom does 49 prostrations daily. Some people do 108. I've had friends who accumulated over time 100,000 prostrations. This is full body, on the floor, fully stretched out, and then stand up and do it again. I read an article many years ago, I think in Tricycle Magazine, about a monk who was walking the Pacific Coast Highway and doing prostrations the whole way. So step, prostration, get up, step, prostration, get up. Can you imagine? You know, as a form of practice. So you might take on something like that if your back will allow it, or you might simply bow in your mind, you know, in the direction of this or that, both as an expression of thankfulness and, when it's appropriate, as an expression of recognition and acceptance of the reality, even if as you oppose that reality, but facing the reality of various things. Okay? Bows. And this leads naturally onward to vows. And the word vow is quite traditional, and it might stir things up in people, like, you know, somehow it reminds me of the Pledge of Allegiance in America and complexities there, or, you know, the Boy Scouts. I was a Boy Scout for a while. And, you know, in effect, promises, commitments, vows. And yet, on the other hand, there's something very fundamental. If you're making your vows for yourself, we have, of course, you know, very formal practices in which, for example, in Buddhism, people vow to undertake the 5 training precepts, basically summarized as, I vow to undertake the training precept of abstaining from killing, abstaining from taking that which is not freely offered, abstaining from sexual misconduct, abstaining from intoxicants, and abstaining from speaking falsely. Now, the way that these 5 are languaged and sequenced can vary somewhat, to be sure. But those are vows, in effect. Very straightforward, foundational moral conduct in Buddhist practice, related to one of the 3 great pillars of practice, of sila, samadhi, and panya, the first one being virtue. You know, what do you stand for? You know, one of the very first things we do when we enter in practice is we kind of clean up our act. I remember way back when, with the EST training, in 1975, I believe, by early 1976, I believe, I was in what was called the Guest Seminar Leaders Program as a young puppy. I mean, I was probably 22 at the time. And one of the very first things you do when you enter that program is you just clean up all kinds of stuff. You put your financial house in order. You list your undelivered communications and deliver the ones that are appropriate to deliver. You clean your closet. You know, you get rid of clothes you don't wear anymore. I mean, you just clean it up. Well, one nice thing about that is it cleans up your mind to clean, to organize those desk drawers. Anyway, so there's a foundation of, you know, ordinary practice. People vow in that regard, quite prosaically, you could say, although there's a world of contemplative practice and wisdom in not getting intoxicated anymore. Whoa. Or, you know, there's a world of practice as you really start looking at not killing. You know, if you're eating, you know, meat of any kind, death was involved in that. But these days, pretty much to live, inevitably we're involved in processes that end the lives of many, many creatures. Small insects, large insects, all kinds of other things. You know, how do you think about that? How do you practice with that? How do you do as little harm as possible? You know, something as simple as not killing can really open up a lot of things. You know, how do you feel about tax dollars that you have to pay or you go to jail being used for military purposes? You know, how do you feel about friends who deliberately hunt or fish in order to kill, unless they're doing catch and release fishing, you know, living creatures that maybe they take home and eat, but on that particular day, that deer did not need to die because you went hunting. And I don't say any of this critically. My dad grew up on a ranch and, you know, I have relatives who are avid hunters and it's complicated. So something as simple as not killing can open up a lot of deep practice. Not taking what is freely offered. It's interesting. walking down a street, reflecting on the so-called male gaze. Is it experienced oppressively by people who did not particularly offer that for view? Whoa, that's something to reflect on. You know, you move through an area and you see someone's notebook open or something like that. Do you take a look, even though they didn't freely offer it? So these simple precepts have a lot of moral depth to them, a lot of practice to them. Additionally, as you may know, in the history of Buddhism, in the development several hundred years after the Buddha himself died, in the Mahayana traditions, there's the emergence of the notion of the bodhisattva, someone who chooses to defer their complete liberation from the wheel of life and death in that cosmology, which rebirth is just simply presumed. They defer complete release from that wheel until everyone is released from it. Wow. And particularly in Zen, there are various formal vows that are really quite elaborate and powerful and profound. You know, so there's different aspects of vowing, certainly in Buddhism. For you, what are you committed to? What have you already vowed? And if you're interested in a little writing practice, a little exercise, that's a good one. You know, what have I already vowed to you that you've kept? And by the way, we can undertake this interesting thing. In Buddhism, vows are not framed as commandments from on high. They're framed as aids to practice and aspirational moral commitments to harming as little as possible, all the way to not at all. So they're framed in that way. They're aspirational. So it's understood that you can make a vow knowing that you won't keep it perfectly. A long time ago, I vowed to not speak or act from anger with our children. And I was startled by how much leakage there was in the very first days, you know, as I undertook that commitment. You know, it's okay. Just because it won't be perfect, you can aspire and you can launch and you can head in that direction. So you might want to acknowledge ways in which you've been pretty steadfast in your life. For example, as we age, I think it's quite helpful to look back on your life and ask three questions. Did I bring my heart to it? Did I make efforts? And did I learn along the way? Now, if you face that question, those questions, there could be some squirming. Not in eighth grade. I did a really mean thing there. I didn't bring my heart to it. Okay. Or, wow, I was a serious slacker after I got out of college or whatever and did a lot of drugs, and I sure was not making efforts then. Okay. Acknowledge that. And still, on the whole, I'll bet it's true that pretty much on the whole, you kept faith with yourself. You did keep bringing your heart to your life, even often when it was scary and it took courage. You did keep making efforts, and you learned and grew and healed and developed along the way. You can credit yourself for the keeping of those vows, in effect. And as well, I'm sure many more practical vows, like to your children, your family, your work, even to your future self, that you would go through serious periods of training and difficulty to enable your future self to do the work that you really long to be able to do, or simply to be able to, you know, make a good living and put bread on the table. You know, you kept faith with your future self. You fulfilled your promises, right? Vows are a kind of promise. At this point going forward, I really invite you to consider what might serve you and kind of raise your game, particularly framed as a purpose you give yourself over to. Not framed as some kind of big flashing red light should, you know, from the top down, you know, oppressing you. No, not so. No, framed really as something you give yourself over to. I vow to be sober today. I vow to see the good in others. I vow to pause before speaking or acting from anger. I vow to let go. Right? What might serve you? So I'm going to pause for a moment here. As you reflect, wow, held in this aspirational way, and also held though in with a kind of sacredness and seriousness, like what comes forward for you? I vow to disengage from quarrels with my in-laws. I vow to remember that I get to decide who I spend time with. So I'll be quiet for a moment. You might even like to write down as an exercise, what are your vows going forward? And as you contemplate on this, it's very helpful to get a sense of the enactment of the vow. You know, what it feels like, or what it would be like to enact the vow, and focusing on what is rewarding, what is meaningful or enjoyable, or both, in the enacting of the vow. You know, feeling into that and centering into it, getting in touch with that will really serve you in turning the vow into a habit. Vows and vows. Isn't that pretty cool? And obviously, you know, what we bow to informs our vows, how we declare ourselves, what we're committed to. Sometimes vows are really supported when they're declared publicly. Other people know, like, I had a real moment of truth. It's embarrassing, but I'll tell you. Let's see. I have a very good friend, Bob, and we would often have adventures. He was my first rock climbing partner, and we do stuff like sail together and things, and he lived across the country. Well, soon after our son was born, Bob came to visit, and I remember sitting with Jan with infant Forrest. You know, I have no idea, maybe 3 weeks old, sitting in her lap, and I said, you know, as I would have said before he came along, and it would have been fine before he came along, I said to her, oh, honey, Bob and I are going to go sailing, and we'll get back, and we can bring in some takeout for dinner, okay? She looked at me, not with daggers, but more like stunned disbelief. Which had more impact, actually, than daggers. And I was like, what? And I suddenly realized, wow, I had to take her into account in a whole new kind of way, in which neither of us had to take the other into account previously in terms of how we'd spend a Saturday with a friend or not. You know, we'd connect later, no worries. But now, wow, I had to take her into account and our son in a completely different way. And the vow to do that just landed, you know, my life changed irrevocably right there. And it still changed on the other side of that change. So sometimes a vow will come in that sort of a way, you know, it's just there. It's kind of maybe private. It's not like you're making some kind of fancy declaration. You just know, okay, I'm never going to go there again. Sometimes you have an interaction with another person and you walk away from it and you go, never again, fill in the blank. Never again am I going to yell like that, you know, or never again am I going to put up with that. You just know. What are your vows? There's a kind of vow I want to name. One of the things that I've been really struck by is the great writer and teacher and being, Ta-Nehisi Coates, who I believe just said that privilege is not having to take something into account. Now, there are many sources of privilege, including advantage through disadvantaging others. There's also good luck and effort. You work hard, you put yourself in a position in which you have more privilege, okay. You don't have to take into account certain things. And I think it's really important to take into account what others have to take into account that you don't have to take into account. And if nothing else, taking it into account, which then is the first step toward potentially becoming more of an ally and a resource with the benefits of your privileges to those who don't have those privileges and they have to take certain things into account. So for me, one of the very useful things in this era that tends to drive people into small silos, including with just overwhelming streams of complicated and often deceptive information, seeming purported information, there's a real tendency to bunker up, you know. I think it's really important to keep raising our gaze to everyone and expanding the frame in which we're taking into account what they have to take into account that we don't have to take into account, whoever they might happen to be. And that's another potential vow you might consider, that you're the kind of person who is open to learning what other people have to take into account that you don't have to take into account. You're open to learning about that. You know, very often it's a matter of grief rather than shame. It's not your fault that things are as they are, unless it is to some extent. And we can feel the grief that they are the way they are and let that grief open and soften our heart. So that's a kind of vow as well, to be that sort of a person, which I think is crucially important in the world today. Because, you know, as we stand together, and only as we stand together, can we be big enough to be strong enough to truly change the world and make the world grounded in justice and compassion that we long for. How about we just kind of be quiet for half a minute? And you might rest in your reflections about what we've explored here and what you bow toward and what you are vowing. And I like the fact that bowing and vowing are active conditions. Bowing and vowing along our way. Just imagining very comically many people passing alongside each other, bowing and vowing as we do, as we go through this life. So thank you.